You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 21st of November, 2012, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Nancy Durham. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a bus bomb in Tel Aviv and more attacks on Gaza, yet talk of ceasefire is still in the air as the Israeli-Palestinian conflict moves into its second week.
My sister works 2 minutes away, my friend takes this bus every day. It's scary, but we got used to it in some way.
Crisis in the Democratic Republic of Congo, with rebels on the march vowing to overthrow the president. And we hear from Chrystia Freeland, author of the new book, Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super-Rich and the Fall of Everyone Else.
There are some powerful economic transformations happening in the world, most notably globalization and the technology revolution, and that these really disruptive changes, and largely benign ones, by the way, are what is driving this wealth gap.
And a leading Turkish broadcaster tells us what's shaping the media landscape back home. All that and more right here on Midori House over the next 60 minutes. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Turkey has asked NATO to deploy Patriot missiles on its territory to help defend itself against any Syrian attacks. The NATO Secretary General, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, said that any missile deployment would be a defensive measure to counter mortar rounds.
It would contribute to the de-escalation of the crisis along NATO's southeastern border. And it would be a concrete demonstration of alliance, solidarity and resolve. In its letter, the Turkish government stressed that the deployment will be defensive only and that it will in no way support a no-fly zone or any offensive operation.
International lenders have failed for the second week to reach a deal to release emergency aid for Greece and will try again next Monday. But Germany signalled that significant divisions remain. Eurozone finance ministers, the International Monetary Fund and the European Central Bank were unable to agree in 12 hours of overnight talks in Brussels on how to make the country's debt sustainable. It's now the eighth day of an Israeli offensive against the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip, which has so far killed at least 139 Palestinians. International efforts to secure a ceasefire in Gaza are intensifying. The United Nations Secretary-General Ban Ki-moon condemned an attack on Tel Aviv today after meeting Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi.
I'm particularly concerned about the spiral of violence at a time of intense efforts to reach a ceasefire in Gaza and Israel. We all know there are many details to work out, but while that happens, civilians continue to die. Cities continue to be targeted. That is why we need a ceasefire right now, immediately.
The head of the United Nations mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Roger Meece, has today briefed the UN Security Council on the capture of the city of Goma by the M23 rebels.
At this stage, the M23 effectively occupies a significant portion of North Kivu province, and it has been establishing a formal administrative or governing structure. We have received numerous reports of targeted summary executions of those who stand in their way, including government and traditional leaders who resist or fail to cooperate with an M23 administrative structure.
Here, several thousand students from across the country protested in central London today over rising tuition fees and cuts to education. Combined with a tough labour market as the euro crisis bites, students like Sophie Bennett are worried about their future.
People don't know whether they're coming or going, fees are going higher, trying to prevent people to get education when people want higher education. It's sort of a downward spiral because if they don't have education, they can't go on to jobs that they do want. It's downward spiral.
And finally, a prosecutor has today said that a woman in Sweden has been charged with engaging in sexual activities with a human skeleton and could face time in prison for disturbing the peace of the dead. Police found a full human skeleton, skulls, and a box containing other human bones by chance after responding to a call which said a shot had been fired from the woman's flat in the city of Gothenburg. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Jonathan Wheatley there with the news at 5 minutes past the hour. You are listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vanuit London, dit is Monocle 24.
London으로부터 Monocle 24입니다.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
Oi, London, 这是 Monocle 24.
Ot London, tu vai Monocle 24.
Fra London, dette Monocle 24.
From London, this is Londres.
Hollanda.
London으로부터 Hong Kong.
Hong Kong.
Zurich.
London.
This is Monocle 24.
Well, through the night, diplomats worked frantically towards a ceasefire in the now eight-day-old Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Alas, rockets flew into Gaza overnight, and today a bomb on a bus in Tel Aviv left many people injured and in shock. Even so, right now, a ceasefire agreement has evidently been reached. Earlier, our reporter in Tel Aviv talked with local people about the violence.
I'm sad, but not scared, no. It brings us back to a period that we all wanted to forget, I think. And once again, I think we all need to remember what are the dangers that we are facing. But you know, we are used to it. The purpose of the terrorist is to make us all scared and to change our daily life, and we mustn't do it, because if we do it, they win. Because with the bombing and the terrorist attack on innocent people, they can't achieve the goal that they have. And the goal is to scare us off this land and off this country. And this they can't achieve. The only thing that they could achieve is to make us all frightened and to change our way of life. And we mustn't do it.
Of course, my sister works 2 minutes away. My friend takes this bus every day. It's scary, but we got used to it in some way. The only reason I'm supportive of the operation in that we're bombing Gaza and everything, because of the South, their lives are being really, for the last 12 years, I've got family in Ashdod, they're living in shelters. It's not very nice. My brothers didn't go to school for over a month, and it hasn't been quiet for them for a long, 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 long time. So for them, for us to think that they're citizens just like us, and it's important. It's important for us to make them feel they belong, they are part of us, we're not forgetting them.
Before 10 years, 20 years, it was a lot of bombas like this. Maybe 3 times in a week, in Tel Aviv too, in Jerusalem. And it was Saddam Hussein that hit in a rocket here. And it's like lottery. In Israel, I don't know, it's not like Gaza, that a lot of people died there. In Tel Aviv, it's exactly like lottery, the people that died here. So I don't need to be afraid, only to take care of myself, my family, to get inside to the shelter. Until now, it's okay because they hit the missiles there, mm-hmm. All the kind of missiles. But to get inside there, all the force, not good. It's not give nothing, it only kill people to get inside. Only the missile to hit, and I think it needs to be finished before 3 days.
Yeah, I'm so afraid, and I call the school of my son, I tell them, I ask all the teachers, everything is okay, they say yes, yes. I'm so afraid, very, very afraid. They want to do peace, but a lot of Israelis don't want because they're tired for this thing. All the time they're okay, and they're sending again this thing. It's very sad to see another side also and this side also. I'm afraid also. They are also afraid in Gaza. They want to do peace, but a lot of Israelis don't want because they're tired for this thing. All the time they're okay, and they're sending again this thing. It's very sad to see another side also and this side also. I'm afraid also. They are also afraid in Gaza, but it's not a good situation. It's good to be peace.
Well, our Middle East contributor, Rebecca Collard, recorded those voices a little earlier today before the news of the ceasefire broke. She is in Tel Aviv tonight. Good evening, Rebecca.
Hi, good evening.
Is there a deal tonight?
We're waiting at 8:30 local time, so about 30 minutes from now, maybe 20 minutes from now, we are going to have a statement by the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. So that should confirm what we're hearing now, which is that there is an agreement for some form of a truce.
Okay, or more than a ceasefire? Truce means ceasefire.
No,
what do you say?
I'm sorry. Actually, it's really interesting. It kind of reflects things that a lot of people were saying, and a lot of Israelis said to me today is that they don't want a temporary solution. They don't want. They want a permanent solution to this problem, and that is not what they're getting. According to the reports that I've seen now, is basically it's going to be a no-fire agreement. I just saw in one of the local papers here that it said basically that there is going to be an unsigned agreement not to fire. So what does that mean? That means that they're both going to be quiet, but if something happens, Israel will take action. I think the big problem here is that Hamas can sign onto this agreement, but it does not necessarily have a monopoly on the use of force inside the Gaza Strip. So it has, you know, a level of control, but is definitely not necessarily able to control all the different militant groups. So that's a definite risk to this agreement. And just to be very clear, from what I'm seeing now, we're not talking about a truce. We're not talking about a peace agreement. We're talking about an agreement not to fire, which is great in that it means probably no or few deaths in the coming days, but not necessarily something sustainable.
And as you say, absolutely no guarantees. Well, you have to say, you know, looking at the situation, it's something that they could arrive at even a little bit of a peaceful agreement at this moment when you saw that bus going up today and exploded with a bomb exploding on it today in Tel Aviv. That's the first time in quite a few years in the city there. The anger and tension must have been extremely high. And then, of course, there was retaliation, I gather, throughout the day back into Gaza.
Yeah, actually, some people were scared, as you heard from the people I interviewed. Some people were scared and angry, but a lot of people were defiant. There is definitely an attitude here, I think, in Tel Aviv especially. You know, often people talk about Tel Aviv being a bubble outside of Israel, not experiencing the same problems, let's say, as people in the south. But as a couple of people mentioned in the Vox Pops you just heard, that they did suffer for a long time this suicide bombings on buses, you know, very, very frequently. So there is an attitude of defiance. What the one gentleman said that when you're scared, you let terrorists win. And so the streets are maybe a little bit quieter than usual, but people here seem relatively defiant, maybe a bit scared, but also kind of not wanting to change their lives. So it's interesting.
It is interesting. I heard another reporter talking about how shocking it was that people would be worried, is this a new kind of violence that's going to hit the streets of Tel Aviv? But of course, memories are short. These used to be, you know, regular occurrences there. So the people have, in some sense, taken it in their stride, have they, today in Tel Aviv?
Yeah, it seems like, in some sense, taking it in stride, absolutely. But yes, I think that if the situation was like it was years ago, where you did have very frequent bombing of buses, that would be a different situation. And a couple of people did mention it was reminiscent of this, but also that because of that, they're used to it. And I mean, it was definitely scary, I think, for a lot of people, but also definitely this attitude of defiance here in Tel Aviv.
Now, you were very clear at how shaky this agreement, which actually has not been, officially announced, how shaky it's going to be. But as you've been saying, and we're hearing here too, day and night, that the long-term peaceful solution is required and desired by parties. Is there, I don't know, any new take on what that solution is going to be, if it comes along, or on whether some special new group is going to be set up to try to move that forward?
I haven't heard anything specifically to any sort of kind of new group that would be set up to manage kind of a looking at a longer term peaceful solution. I know that the ceasefire that they were talking about last night was something more complex. There was rumors that it was going to involve a lifting of the blockade and a number of other conditions, which I guess would be something kind of more substantial and maybe more sustainable than what we're looking at tonight. But it's a difficult situation. It's a very long conflict now, and I think also part of the problem is, of course, there is this division between the West Bank and Gaza. So we have Mahmoud Abbas and his Palestinian Authority in the West Bank, and Hillary Clinton was there today speaking with him, but he is divided from Gaza. There is no reconciliation yet between the West Bank government and the Hamas government, and that, of course, is an obstacle to any sort of, if we're talking about like a long-term solution for the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, that's an absolute obstacle, because I think especially in the last few days, we've seen a division even further between the West Bank and Gaza. So well in the West Bank, there's been protests and such. The objectives of the government in the West Bank and the objectives of Hamas are very different these days. So I think that's an absolute obstacle to a kind of a very final agreement solution. But as far as like a longer, more sustainable agreement between Hamas and Israel, I guess maybe if we see the stopping of the hostilities now, perhaps there will be some space to discuss that.
Thank you very much. Let's hope for that. Rebecca Collard, our person in Tel Aviv this evening, our Monocle contributor there. Thank you.
Section D is Monocle 24's show about design. Each week we take you on a whistle-stop tour of the people and places making a splash in the world of craft, architecture, graphics, fashion and retail.
How do you explain the value of design? What can we do to make clients and designers work better together?
On the latest episode, we talk the future. We attend the first Fashion Week in Haiti. We look at the changing skyline of Barcelona. And we drop in on Green Build, the sustainable construction trade fair in San Francisco.
If you look at a building where most of the energy is lost, that actually happens at the building facade. The windows are actually a critical point in managing energy efficiency of a building.
That's Section D with Hugo MacDonald, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
The Entrepreneurs is about the movers and shakers, the lone rangers, the innovators, the modern mercantile mavericks, and the venerable merchandisers. It's Monocle 24's weekly business show. Every week, we seek out the startups, the brands on the make, and the leaders of global business empires doing things differently.
Assume you don't know the answer. If you assume that, you have to start creating options for yourself.
From master cobblers to asset managers, from impresarios in the luxury yacht sector to tech startups shaking up Silicon Valley. Tune in on Wednesdays at 1900 hours London time, or download the show on Monocle 24's website.
That's The Entrepreneurs, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 hours UK time, in association with Pictet.
You are listening to Midori House, and it is 19 minutes past 1800 here in London, which means it's 19 minutes past 1900 in Warsaw, which is where we're heading right now to hear from our foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield, who's there on assignment for a future issue of the magazine. Hi, Steve.
Nancy, hello.
How are things this evening in Poland?
Not too bad. I've just come back from the foreign ministry, where I've been meeting with Poland's foreign minister, Radek Sikorski, as you say, for an interview that's going to run in our February issue. But what was particularly interesting is that we were, as well as talking about broader issues, talking about the EU meeting tomorrow, where the 27 EU member states are going to be discussing the budget for the next 7 years, and it's already, before they've even got there, fraught with tension as to what's actually going to happen.
One can't really imagine a seven-year budget. Well, I mean, how many gazillion, million, trillion pounds or dollars or whatever euros that would be?
It's relatively small in terms of the size. It's the European Commission has a budget of around $1.1 billion. But the issue is whether you can have a situation where 27 member states can all agree on it. And that's the issue at the moment, because they all have the power of veto. And in the UK, David Cameron has been threatening to veto any deal that's struck which sees any sort of increase in this budget. And Radek Sikorski was pretty dismissive of Cameron's tactics, which is surprising, partly because he's quite a blunt diplomat, and most diplomats aren't, but also surprising because these two men should be allies. You know, they're both on the right, they both went to Oxford around the same time, they have an awful lot in common.
Okay, well, let's look into that a little bit. Can you tell us, I mean, what does he say about Cameron? What does he think he should, what's his take? Where they're not playing ball enough?
His problem with David Cameron is that he doesn't know what Cameron actually wants. There's been Cameron's come under a lot of pressure over the past few weeks from many of his backbenchers, also people within his cabinet, who are coming around to the idea that maybe Britain shouldn't be in the European Union at all. Ed Miliband, the Labour Party leader, the opposition leader in England, in the UK, has said that Britain is sleepwalking toward the exit of Europe. And Mr. Sikorski made it clear that he thought that it would be an absolute disaster for Britain if they left the European Union. And his main concern was he didn't really know what it was Cameron was after. Is he trying to get a better deal, or is he trying to veto the whole thing?
Very interesting. And am I right in understanding that the Polish foreign minister is turning to or looking to Germany to show more leadership?
Certainly, yes. I mean, as I say, he's fairly blunt as a diplomat. He was quite happy to criticise a number of leaders during our interview. And one country he has been pretty critical of in the past couple of years is Germany. Last year he went to Berlin, made a speech in the Bundestag, essentially calling for stronger German leadership. The irony of a Polish foreign minister going to Berlin to call for stronger German leadership was not lost on him. And I think it just shows how desperate Europe really is for that sort of leadership. And it's interesting that at the moment, you know, it's only really coming from ministers like Radek Sikorski, who are willing to be a bit blunt about things.
And is Sikorski sticking his neck out like this because of his passion for a united Europe? Is it because he's looking out for the best interests of Poland, or he's trying to prevent future conflicts? And where's his heart and mind?
Well, I think all those things play a role. It's very easy for people, you know, who don't have experience of Eastern Europe to forget about, you know, about the region's recent history. There was a dinner that he was at a while ago where a British Eurosceptic MP said to him, why do you Poles throw your lot in with Brussels? Why do you bother with that? To which Sikorski replied, oh, so we should just rely on Britain like we did in 1939. And I think, exactly, and it's, you know, they realise that a stronger Europe means that they're less likely to be invaded, that their economy is going to be stronger, and that's the benefit of everyone. So, you know, they see what happens in, he described, you know, what happens in other countries, said, you know, those countries within the European Union, we don't really see them as abroad anymore. What happens there has a huge impact on us. So we don't feel like there's a problem going to Berlin, for example, and saying, you need to do more. Or saying to François Hollande, you know, we disagree with you, you need to do more here. Because what happens in Paris, what happens in Berlin, has a huge impact on life in Warsaw.
Steve, it's very good to have you out there on the story for us, and we'll be looking forward to the February edition, but looking forward to having you back here soon first.
Thank you, Nancy.
Thank you very much. Monocle's foreign editor, Steve Bloomfield. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Nancy Durham. Well, rebels on the march in the Democratic Republic of Congo say they're on their way to overthrowing President Kabila. Kabila himself is apparently in crisis talks with neighboring Rwanda and Uganda, countries the UN has accused of backing the rebels. Alex Duval-Smith is our South Africa correspondent, and she's on the line right now from Cape Town. Hello, Alex.
Hi, Nancy.
Can we just start off with this group, M23? Not everybody knows it. It's a rebel group. Who are they, and does it have popular support?
Absolutely. M23 is actually a rebel group that was formed out of, it's named after a peace accord which was signed on the 23rd of March 2009. It was a peace accord that was seen as bringing into line the rebel groups which to a certain extent exist in eastern DRC to defend the Tutsi government, if you like, in Rwanda, the Tutsis who were the main victims of the 1994 genocide, against forces they claim to be Hutu genocidaire, people who were responsible for the genocide. So this whole background has created a ripe playing field for rebels for fighting and destabilized eastern Congo for the best part of getting on for two decades. M23 was on the 23rd of March 2009 was actually a group of rebels who were incorporated in the Congolese government army, but shortly afterwards they staged a rebellion and they took up arms as M23. Two of their leading leaders, two of their top commanders, are actually wanted by the International Criminal Court for war crimes and for recruiting child soldiers.
But on some level, they're looking for justice after the genocide in Rwanda all these many years ago.
Well, that's exactly what President Paul Kagame of Rwanda would say. He would argue that Rwanda still remains under threat of a Hutu invasion from the West, and that's why Rwanda has to keep a watchful eye on that border. Rwanda has a direct border with DRC, and Goma is literally meters inside the DRC. He would argue that that is why Rwanda needs to keep a watchful eye on the situation. Others would argue that it's all about resources, it's all about minerals, it's all about forestry, it's all about supplying Rwanda and also Uganda with very, very valuable natural resources.
Okay, so how strong is this M23, and can they actually get to Kinshasa and take over?
Well, I mean, it's very, very hard to say. The diplomats are sort of giving figures about the M23 of between 1,000 men and 6,000 men. We don't know very much about their weaponry. We don't really know whether they are literally, as they say, on their way to Kinshasa. We really don't know if they've just been sort of put there to stir things up and to shake up and frighten Joseph Kabila in Kinshasa. It's a long way from Goma to Kinshasa. It's nearly 2,000 kilometers. So, you know, it's one to watch, and I think we're not at that stage yet.
Okay, then let's just take a step back. These rebels moved into Goma just the other day?
On Monday.
Okay, and I understand the UN was there, and some reports are suggesting that they didn't do much but stand around and allow this to happen. Can we corroborate those reports? Is it that bad?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that is a criticism of the UN that has been leveled time and again in eastern Congo and also in other conflict areas of the world. UN peacekeepers, of course, are only as good as their mandate. UN peacekeepers spend a lot of their time on patrols. These UN peacekeepers, this is the biggest UN peacekeeping mission of in the world, with 19,000 police and military. But it's a huge country. It's a country the size of Europe, with rebel groups, more than one rebel group operating. So the line of fire is not clear. Plus, of course, you're dealing in a country which has extremely poor governance and whose own army is very, very weak, ill-equipped and ill-motivated. So, yes, I think it's easy to say the UN should have done more, and I think it's right to see that it's as fairly shocking that the UN peacekeepers in Goma just appeared to stand by the roadside as the M23 walked in. But I think the solutions to that are not just simple. It's not as simple as saying the UN should have fired back, because the UN probably still would have been overwhelmed. It's all about mandates. It's about the UN Security Council looking at MONUSCO. MONUSCO is the name of the UN force in Goma, looking at their mandate, which they're going to be doing today, and finding some solutions that go beyond firepower.
Okay, well, as you say, it's a long walk to Kinshasa, so and it is one to watch. Thank you for watching it for us, and we'll be back to you on it. Thank you. Monocle's Alex Duval Smith in South Africa. In the next half hour of the program, we'll be discussing the media landscape in Turkey, and we'll delve into the newest issue of Monocle magazine with our design editor, Hugo MacDonald. But first, here's Jonathan Wheatley with the news headlines.
I'm Nancy, sorry. Thank you very much indeed. Turkey has asked NATO to deploy Patriot missiles on its territory to help defend itself against any Syrian attacks. The NATO Secretary General said that any missile deployment would be a defensive measure to counter mortar rounds. International lenders have failed for the second week to reach a deal to release emergency aid for Greece and will try again next Monday, but Germany has signalled that significant divisions remain. It's now the eighth day of an Israeli offensive against the Hamas-ruled Gaza Strip, which has so far killed at least 139 Palestinians. The United Nations Secretary General condemned an attack on Tel Aviv today after meeting the Egyptian president. The head of the United Nations mission in the Democratic Republic of Congo, Roger Mees, has today briefed the United Nations Security Council on the capture of the city of Goma by the M23 rebels there. And here, several thousand students from across the country protested in central London today over rising tuition fees and cuts to education. And those are the stories on Monocle 24.
And here we are in Midori House. It's time for just a little music. We have something from a live Midori session right out of our archive. It's called Spaghetti by Wave Pictures.
I kick and you doggy paddle. Tumbling from the center of your skull like spaghetti. I knew then that you'd never forget me. I knew then that you'd never.
Well, that was Spaghetti by Wave Pictures. This is Midori House on M24 or Monocle 24, and we are coming to you live from London. Who is the richest person who ever lived? Any idea? Well, given the impossibility of comparing chariots with private jets, it is perhaps an absurd question. However, it is one economists have sought to answer. It's not the Roman emperors or John D. Rockefeller, but rather the current billionaires of Silicon Valley and the oligarchs who plundered Russia. Topping them all, apparently, is the Mexican telecom tycoon, Carlos Slim. This new class of uber-rich is the subject of Plutocrats, the Rise of the New Global Super-Rich, by former Financial Times deputy editor Chrystia Freeland. Monocle's Adrian Craddock talked with Chrystia.
So the title of your book, the subtitle rather, is The Rise of the New Global Super Rich. Why do you say the rise? Surely there's always been a real kind of upper echelon in society.
There has, but this time really is different. The gap between those at the very, very top of the income distribution and everyone else is as high as it was during the Gilded Age, that sort of peak in the early 20th, late 19th century. Some economists think it is higher than it has ever been in human history. So we are really living through something different from the experience of most people alive today, and quite different from our previous historical experience.
In that sense, does that mean that the absolute uber rich today are richer than any other part of that society throughout history? I mean, it's never been so unequal?
That is what some people argue. So a guy called Branko Milanović, who is a wonderful economist, he's at the World Bank, wrote a great paper a couple of years ago. And his object in the paper was to discover the richest person who ever lived. And he admits, you know, that this is a somewhat iffy exercise, you know, because how do you compare owning slaves with owning a private jet? The opportunities for wealth are different over time. But anyway, having stipulated all of that, Branko goes through it. He talks about the Romans. He talks about the pharaohs. And he determines in the end that the richest person who ever lived is Carlos Slim, the Mexican billionaire.
The current richest.
The current one richer than anybody else. Now, some people would dispute that. But what is absolutely clear is, you know, we are reaching a peak. Maybe the robber barons were at the same sort of Olympian heights, but this is pretty exceptional. And all the signs are that this accumulation of wealth at the very top and the growing chasm between the people at the very top and the middle class, which is simultaneously in the industrialized West being hollowed out, that gap is growing.
Is there a hypothesis as to why now that there's such inequality?
Yes. Yeah. I mean, there are hypotheses. There are lots of arguments. Mm-hmm. You can generally tell someone's politics by which theory they like. So the right tends to prefer the economic argument, the argument that there are some powerful economic transformations happening in the world, most notably globalization and the technology revolution, and that these really disruptive changes, and largely benign ones, by the way, are what is driving this wealth gap. The left tends to prefer political arguments, so they will emphasize changes in tax treatment, lower taxes on the super rich, changes in regulation, this wave of deregulation and liberalization, a new attitude towards CEO compensation, more tolerance of a bigger gap between the CEO and the ordinary worker, weaker unions. That's what the left will stress. I actually tend to agree with the economic arguments. I think the big driver is this economic transformation. And one piece of evidence for that way of looking at what's happening is this is a truly international phenomenon. It's been striking for me that one of the theses of my book is that this is international, and really going on book tour has confirmed that, because, you know, I've spoken to Irish journalists, I've spoken to Australian journalists, I've spoken to Norwegian journalists, Canadians, Americans, Brits. Everybody asks very similar questions, responding to and speaking about a very similar phenomenon in their own country. It's happening to all of us.
I was going to ask you about that. I mean, so you think that this phenomenon is completely across the globe? Because usually, you know, when we talk about this class of uber rich, the US kind of comes to mind, this idea of, you know, the 1%, so forth. But is this a completely global thing?
This is a global phenomenon. So it is happening, and there is a meaningful difference between what's happening in the industrialized West and what is happening in the emerging markets, although they have a lot in common and there is a powerful relationship. But yes, this is global. To take the industrialized West, it's happening pretty much everywhere. For a while, economists noted, you know, with some pleasure that France was an exception, right? France always has to be an exception. But recent data has suggested that you're seeing the same phenomenon in France too. Meanwhile, in the emerging markets, they're experiencing something a little bit different from the industrialized West, because they are actually industrializing. You know, in some ways, they are going through their version of the 19th century, only speeded up. But there as well, in most of the emerging markets, you are having a sharp increase in income inequality. Brazil is the big outlier. But the reason for that is, you know, Brazil, when it began this latest economic growth spurt, had one of the highest levels of income inequality on the planet. There really wasn't much room for the gap to grow in Brazil.
While it's hard to really have any sympathy, in some ways, it seems almost lonely. It seems like there's just an absolute handful of these people that are miles away from anyone else living this kind of lifestyle. Is that something that you think is an issue here? I mean, it seems like it's really just a handful of these people that can afford this.
I do actually have sympathy with, you know, these plutocrats, the super rich. And I think very many of them are really admirable people. This is often self-made. And that's not to say these are people who were born in abject poverty. You know, if you want to be a billionaire, it is very wise to begin by being born to an affluent middle-class family. That's a good start. But they built their fortunes themselves. They tend not to have inherited them. And they are, I don't think it's so much lonely, actually, but I think they inhabit a world quite separate from the one in which they grew up and quite separate from the one inhabited by the middle class back home. These people are really becoming a global tribe. You know, one of them, an American, said to me, you know, I probably have more in common with an African businessman who also went to Harvard Business School, and he probably has more in common with me than he does with his own home community. Mm-hmm. So that it's that kind of a world. I think actually it's quite an exciting world, but it is international and, you know, crucially distant, and I think more distant than the plutocrats themselves really realize from everybody else.
And Adrian was talking with Chrystia Freeland, author of Plutocrats, The Rise of the New Global Super Rich. You're listening to Midori House. In just a moment, we'll be assessing the media landscape in Turkey.
This Christmas, Monocle invite you to Midori House for our first Christmas fair. Mixing up the best of Swedish Yule, Japanese Christmaser, and traditional English Yuletide, we'll be serving up festive cheer at the most elegant Christkindlmarkt in the heart of W1. We'll have live music with a Swedish choir, food by Granger & Co. and our hand-picked retailers can help you with your Christmas shopping. Plus, you can meet a real, live reindeer. So, head to number 1 Dorset Street on the 1st and 2nd of December from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. to meet our Finnish Santa and all his little helpers at the Monocle Christmas Fair.
It sounds like that reindeer is right here in the studio with me. Do not miss the fair. It's going to be fantastic. And you are listening to Midori House. The time now is 45 minutes past 1800 right here in London. Now, one of the biggest names in Turkish media is Cüneyt Özdemir, co-anchor of a leading evening news program on CNN Turk and a columnist for the Radical newspaper. Özdemir is currently working on his shows from London, but he made some time in his busy schedule to drop into Midori House to share his insights on the state of the media in Turkey and to reflect on the role it can play in selling the country around the world. Cüneyt described the landscape of networks, newspapers, and new media to Monocle's news editor, Tom Edwards.
Cüneyt, I wanted to start by asking you your general impressions about the sort of media landscape of Turkey currently. Obviously, you're a veteran, if you like, in TV, in newspapers. What's your view? Do you have any concerns, for example, about the balance of the media, or do you think that it's a flourishing industry there?
In Turkey, you know, last few years, maybe last 3 years, the ownership of the conventional media is changing hand, because in the Turkish media ownership, when you look at that, you see that the businessmen who are running other business in the different areas also own the media, and most of them most of them, not all of them, but most of them are using the media as a carrot or sometimes as a, you know, to punish the governments about what do they do in their other businesses. So the Turkish media ownership is changing very fastly. It's not like in Britain, it's not like in United States. Every 10 years, we see new owners. They sell the media, and with the new governments, the new owners are coming and entering the media. So last 3 or 4 years, we can say that 50% of the media is supporting the government. The owners are supporting the governments, and the journalists who are, even we cannot say that they are not supporters, they are not criticizing the government as much as the others. And the other 50% is still, they are criticizing and they are trying to be journalists.
But do you find that it's a difficult balance? Is it hard to, if you're a columnist, if you're trying to write, you know, opinion, is there pressure then from these owners, although they change, or is it easy to be still quite objective about things?
It's not easy, because the main issue is, in these years, you learn that what you have to write, or what, if you write something criticizing, for example, the government strongly, you know that what will happen. So the worst thing then, for a journalist, a very bad thing happens, you start your auto-censor. So you know that, oh, if I criticize this minister, it will be a problem for me in the future. It could be a problem. So, okay, no need to write it. Or if you write it, for example, if you say that, no, it's my opinion and I'm a journalist and I will write it in any way. So we see some examples that they fired them from their newspapers, TV stations.
And I wondered then, I mean, obviously we read sometimes in Western Europe about a number of journalists who are, you know, even jailed because they're dissenting voices. Is that a concern? Do you think that that makes it difficult for Turkey sometimes to get its message out there? Because people say, well, hang on, is the media really free enough? You know, are there enough independent voices? Do you think it's difficult then for the message to go internationally?
You know, it's not easy to be a columnist in Turkish media because, as you said, now nearly 90 journalists, some of them are my close friends, are still in jail. And when you look at the courts, the judges ask them, why did you write this article? What was this news about? You know, they're discussing a journalistic stuff, not a terroristic stuff. And they say that you are a terrorist. For example, the government's main idea is these guys are terrorists. They are not journalists. They are in court because what they do is a terrorist. But when you look at the courts, most of them, we can include not only Turkish, also the Kurdish one. Most of them, they are asking, why did you make this interview? Why did you write this column? And why did you make this broadcasting? So it's not easy to say that we have a free press in Turkey now.
We're talking a lot on Monocle 24 at the moment about the question of sort of soft power. I just wondered it very briefly. How well do you think Turkey does in terms of pushing its cultural side internationally, both using its media, using its other forms of cultural expression? Do you think the country is getting very good at doing that?
In 5 years, I think because of the television, the serials, the Turkish serials becomes very popular. I talk to some of my friends, the producers and the managers, the directors of the TVs. They were in Cannes, you know, at MIPCOM, the bazaar, they are selling the serials. And the Turkish serials, for example, one of them is the Muhteşem Yüzyıl. It's the Great Ottoman, let's say. And they told me that they sold it 40 different countries, and most of the serials are, you know, they are running everywhere. I think last five years, this becomes a part of, we can give an example, like we are using soft power in this way.
I was going to ask very briefly, you're obviously over in the UK currently. What do you make of the sort of the media landscape here?
It's very interesting because I'm running my show in AP Studios here. So I'm looking at the issues, what are we talking about, and I'm checking what the British colleagues are looking after them. For example, a young girl, 13 or 15 years old, ran away with her teacher, maths teacher, and it was the main news for the news programs or the newspapers. But at the same time, we were talking about, you know, the PKK attacks the Turkish army and 10 deaths, and we are nearly at Syria, fired and crashed our plane, an army plane, and a traffic accident, and it was 20 deaths. And in the politics, you know, everybody is saying lots of bad words to each other. I said, oh my God, I went to James Bond here. I said to my colleagues that, you know, it looks very interesting, these James Bond movies, you know, in the bazaars, somebody is running after them. Every day we are living in a James Bond country, and this is not very interesting for us. There is no war, there is no attacks, you know. It's like a taxi driver fight. It's a very ordinary thing for us.
It's an amazing, amazing comparison. Well, thanks so much for sharing your insights on it.
Yeah, thank you.
And that was Janed Özdemir speaking earlier with Monocle's Tom Edwards. And our Midori House Hour is just flying by, and with the latest edition of Monocle magazine out this week on the shelves of your local bookstore, your favorite newsagent, well, every day this week, that means we at Midori House are going to draw your attention to some of the great stories in the magazine. And today, it's design editor Hugo MacDonald's turn, and he's, I'm delighted to say, right here with design on his mind. Hello. And we're going to talk Helsinki.
We are indeed. We are... In this very special forecast issue, went to Helsinki as winter was just settling in to visit the perfect apartment to spend winter. And this is told over six pages. It's the top of a five-storey building from the 1920s, and it's the home of one of Finland's greatest design collectors. It's
and
beautiful.
You gave me a little hint before. It's a guy and it's a style in Finland to actually love and live with your objects. You don't put them behind the glass cases, you use them.
Exactly. I mean, the sort of founding ethos of modern Finnish design was that you have things that you live with and you use every day. And they're made so well and so simply that they improve with age. And this apartment is a testament to that. He has an extraordinary collection of furniture, tableware, glassware. Many of which are original pieces, some of which are over 70 years old, and he lives with them and uses them. And it's a sort of party pad, which not in a bachelor sense, but in a way that he invites all his friends around and they all pull up their Alvar Aalto stools and have big feasts with this amazing crockery and glassware, and then go to the sauna in the bathroom, which is my favourite.
How many people can get into the bathroom sauna? It's quite something to have in your fifth floor apartment.
No, it's surprisingly spacious, because he actually ripped out the original layout of the apartment, which had servants' quarters and six rooms, and turned it into an open plan. It is really just one room. The sauna can fit probably about 20 people, I'd say.
And on this across these several pages, absolutely good. I dropped the ball there. Did you get into the sauna? No.
No.
No, you saw it. She didn't come. Okay. So, but all
it
these,
might have been too intimate for just me and
perhaps.
Him.
Perhaps. Oh, yeah. Perhaps a little awkward for your interview. But look, you've got beautiful colors there. Autumn shades and soft browns and beiges and lovely sort of faded oranges and even a few bright ones. But maybe I could ask you, did you kind of have a favorite object or see something there you just wished you could take?
Well, Tapio Virkola is one of Finland's greatest glassware designers. He's sadly no longer with us. But he really turned glass into an art form.
And I have some.
You have some, exactly.
I have six Sauterne glasses.
He's collected around the world. And Juhani Lametti, who is the owner of the apartment, has probably the finest collection of anyone in the world. Many original, one-off, huge vases, which for the photo shoot I was precariously kind of lifting and carrying around, just praying, because I'm so cack-handed that I wasn't going to trip or drop.
Yeah,
and no, luckily everything
careful.
Remained intact.
You were saying the city, I mean, you were there just as winter was coming on, and it gets very cold and bitter there, I think. And
it does.
The city kind of hibernates, so you've got to have an apartment that's winter worthy.
Absolutely. And this is something that people who haven't been to Helsinki or Finland or people who maybe have only been once, they go there and they say, well, you know, it's so miserable and how could you ever survive the winters? But the residents in Helsinki have such an amazing sort of hibernating skill, thanks in part to how cozy these places are, that they hunker down in winter. And when I was there, it was just rolling in. The days were very short, leaves were all off the trees, snow felt kind of imminent in the sky. It wasn't yet the thick of winter, but if I had to be there for winter, I would definitely be spending it in this apartment.
So cozy. Mm-hmm. Maybe we've got sort of the better half of a minute for you to tell me, why do you think it is the Finns have this love of objects and that to really want to use them and care for them and enjoy them?
I think they have an amazing heritage with wooden furniture and glass and ceramic. And these are three materials that very simply can be turned into beautiful everyday objects, which, like we started off talking about, only improve with age. And that, together with the Finns of design ethos of simple, everyday, lasting design, you know, means that people love it.
And they keep them and hand them
and
down.
Keep them and hand them down, exactly.
Hugo MacDonald, our design man, thank you so much for that. You took us to Finland. I really like that. And that is all, sadly, we have time for today. Thank you to our producer, Don Trump, and studio manager, Toby Hammond. Our interns, of course, Philly Lim and Imogen Greenhalge. Up next after the news is this week's episode of Entrepreneurs. This week, the team visit the International Herald Tribune Luxury Conference in Rome.
I don't think that we need to transform Africa. I think Africa transforms itself. I think they are more and more aware of what's going on around the world.
In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours here in London, you'll have a chance to hear Hugo MacDonald again, along with Tom Burgess Watson. They'll be doing the Monocle Daily. Andrew Muller will be back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. I'm Nancy Durham, and I want to thank you for listening. Bye-bye.